Warriors, peacekeepers, welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are about to do battle with chapter 23 of book 6. And it goes like this. Prince Andrew needed his father's consent to his marriage, and to obtain this he started for the country next day. His father received his son's communication with external composure, but inward wrath. He could not comprehend how anyone could wish to alert. He could not comprehend how anyone could wish to alter his life or introduce anything new into it, when his own life was already ending. "If only they would let me end my days as I want to," thought the old man, "then they might do as they please." With his son, however, he employed the diplomacy he reserved for important occasions, and, adopting a quiet tone, discussed the whole matter. In the first place, the marriage was not a brilliant one as regards birth, wealth, or rank. Secondly, Prince Andrew was no longer as young as he had been, and his health was poor. The old man laid special stress on this, while she was very young. Thirdly, he had a son whom it would be a pity to entrust to a chit of a girl. "Fourthly and finally," the father said, looking ironically at his son, "I beg you to put it off for a year. Go abroad, take a cure, look out, as you wanted to, for a German tutor for Prince Nicholas. Then, if your love or passion or obstinacy, as you please, is still as great, marry. And that's my last word on it. Mind, the last," concluded the prince, in a tone which showed that nothing would make him alter his decision. Prince Andrew saw clearly that the old man hoped that his feelings or his fiancée's would not stand a year's test, or that he, the old prince himself, would die before then, and he decided to conform to his father's wish to propose and postpone the wedding for a year. 3 weeks after the last evening he had spent with the Rostovs, Prince Andrew returned to Petersburg. Next day, after her talk with her mother, Natasha expected Bolkonski all day, but he did not come. On the second and third day it was the same. Pierre did not come either, and Natasha, not knowing that Prince Andrew had gone to see his father, could not explain his absence to herself. 3 weeks passed in this way. Natasha had no desire to go out anywhere, and wandered from room to room like a shadow, idle and listless. She wept secretly at night, and did not go to her mother in the evenings. She blushed continually and irritably. It seemed to her that everybody knew about her disappointment, and was laughing at her and pitying her, strong as was her inward grief. This wound to her vanity intensified her misery. Once she came to her mother, tried to say something, and suddenly began to cry. Her tears were those of an offended child who does not know why it is being punished. The countess began to soothe Natasha, who, after first listening to her mother's words, suddenly interrupted her. "Leave off, Mama. I don't think and I don't want to think about it. He just came and then left off." Her voice trembled, and she again nearly cried, but recovered and went on quietly. "And I don't at all want to get married, and I am afraid of him. I have now become quite calm." The day after this conversation, Natasha put on the old dress, which she knew had the peculiar property of conducing to cheerfulness in the mornings, and that day she returned to the old way of life, which she had abandoned since the ball. Having finished her morning tea, she went to the ballroom, which she particularly liked for its loud resonance, and began singing her solfeggio. When she had finished her first exercise, she stood still in the middle of the room and sang a musical phrase that particularly pleased her. She listened joyfully, as though she had not expected it, to the charm of the notes reverberating, filling the whole empty ballroom, and slowly dying away, and all at once she felt cheerful. "What's the good of making so much of it? Things are nice as it is," she said to herself. and she began walking up and down the room, not stepping simply on the resounding parquet, but treading with each step from the heel to the toe, she had on a new and favourite pair of shoes, and listening to the regular tap of the heel and the creak of the toe as gladly as she had to the sounds of her own voice. Passing a mirror, she glanced into it. "There, that's me." The expression on her face seemed to say, as she caught sight of herself, "Well, and very nice too. I need nobody." A footman wanted to come in to clear away something in the room, but she would not let him, and having closed the door behind him, continued her walk. That morning she had returned to her favourite mood, love of and delight in herself. "How charming that Natasha is," she said again, speaking as some third collective male person. "Pretty, a good voice, young, and in nobody's way if only they leave her in peace." But however much they left her in peace, she could not now be at peace, and immediately felt this. In the hall, the porch door opened and someone asked, "At home?" And then footsteps were heard. Natasha was looking at the mirror, but did not see herself. She listened to the sounds in the hall. When she saw herself, her face was pale. It was he. She knew this for certain, though she hardly heard his voice through the closed doors. Pale and agitated, Natasha ran into the drawing room. "Mama, Bolkonski has come," she said. "Mama, it is awful, it is unbearable. I don't want to be tormented. What am I to do?" Before the Countess could answer, Prince Andrew entered the room with an agitated and serious face. As soon as he saw Natasha, his face brightened. He kissed the Countess's hand and Natasha's and sat down beside the sofa. "It is long since we had the pleasure," began the Countess. But Prince Andrew interrupted her by answering her intended question, obviously in haste to say what he had to. "I have not been to see you all this time because I have been at my father's. I had to talk over a very important matter with him. I only got back last night," he said, glancing at Natasha. "I want to talk with you, Countess," he added after a moment's pause. The Countess lowered her eyes, sighing deeply. "I am at your disposal," she murmured. Natasha knew that she ought to go away, but was unable to do so. Something gripped her throat, and regardless of manners, she stared straight at Prince Andrew with wide-open eyes. "At once? This instant? No, it can't be," she thought. Again he glanced at her, and the glance convinced her that she was not mistaken. Yet, at once, that very instant, her fate would be decided. "Go, Natasha, I will call you," said the Countess in a whisper. Natasha glanced with frightened, imploring eyes at Prince Andrew and at her mother, and went out. "I have come, Countess, to ask for your daughter's hand," said Prince Andrew. The Countess's face flushed hotly, but she said nothing. "Your offer," she began at last sedately. He remained silent, looking into her eyes. "Your offer," she grew confused, "is agreeable to us, and I accept your offer. I am glad, and my husband, I hope, but it will depend on her. I will speak to her when I have your consent. Do you give it to me?" said Prince Andrew. "Yes," replied the Countess. She held out her hand to him, and with a mixed feeling of estrangement and tenderness pressed her lips to his forehead as he stooped to kiss her hand. She wished to love him as a son, but felt that to her he was a stranger and a terrifying man. "I am sure my husband will consent," said the Countess, "but your father?" "My father, to whom I have told my plans, has made it an express condition of his consent that the wedding is not to take place for a year, and I wished to tell you of that," said Prince Andrew. "It is true that Natasha is still young, but as long as that?" "It is unavoidable," said Prince Andrew with a sigh. "I will send her to you," said the Countess, and left the room. "Lord, have mercy upon us," she repeated, while seeking her daughter. Sonya said that Natasha was in her bedroom. Natasha was sitting on the bed, pale and dry-eyed, and was gazing at the icons and whispering something as she rapidly crossed herself. Seeing her mother, she jumped up and flew to her. "Well, Mama, well?" Go. Go to him. He is asking for your hand, said the Countess, coldly, it seemed to Natasha. Go, go, said the mother, sadly and reproachfully, with a deep sigh, as her daughter ran away. Natasha never remembered how she entered the drawing room. When she came in and saw him, she paused. Is it possible that this stranger has now become everything to me? She asked herself, and immediately answered, yes, everything. He alone is now dearer to me than everything in the world. Prince Andrew came up to her with downcast eyes. I have loved you from the very first moment I saw you. May I hope? He looked at her and was struck by a serious, impassioned expression of her face. Her face said, why ask? Why doubt what you cannot but know? Why speak when words cannot express what one feels? She drew near to him and stopped. He took her hand and kissed it. Do you love me? Yes, yes, Natasha murmured, as if in vexation. Then she sighed loudly and, catching her breath more and more quickly, began to sob. What is it? What's the matter? Oh, I am so happy, she replied, smiling through her tears. And she bent over and closer to him, paused for an instant as if asking herself whether she might, and then kissed him. Prince Andrew held her hands, looked into her eyes, and did not find in his heart his former love for her. Something in him had suddenly changed. There was no longer the former poetic and mystic charm of desire, but there was pity for her feminine and childish weakness, fear at her devotion and trustfulness, and an oppressive yet joyful sense of the duty that now bound him to her forever. The present feeling, though not so bright and poetic as the former, was stronger and more serious. "Did your mother tell you that it cannot be for a year?" asked Prince Andrew, still looking into her eyes. "Is it possible that I, the chit of a girl, as everybody called me," thought Natasha, "is it possible that I am now to be the wife and the equal of this strange, dear, clever man whom even my father looks up to? Can it be true? Can it be true that there can be no more playing with life, that now I am grown up, that on me now lies a responsibility for my every word and deed? Yes, but what did he ask me?" "No," she replied, but she had not understood his question. Forgive me, he said, "but you are so strong, and I have already been through so much in life. I am afraid for you. You do not yet know yourself." Natasha listened with concentrated attention, trying but failing to take in the meaning of his words. "Hard as this year which delays my happiness will be," continued Prince Andrew, "it will give you time to be sure of yourself. I ask you to make me happy in a year, but you are free. Our engagement shall remain a secret. And should you find that you do not love me, or should you come to love," said Prince Andrew with an unnatural smile. "Why do you say that?" Natasha interrupted him. "You know that from the very day you first came to Otradnoe, I have loved you," she cried, quite convinced that she spoke the truth. "In a year, you will learn to know yourself." "A whole year," Natasha repeated suddenly, only now realizing that the marriage was to be postponed for a year. "But why a year? Why a year?" Prince Andrew began to explain to her the reasons for this delay. Natasha did not hear him. "And can't it be helped?" she asked. Prince Andrew did not reply, but his face expressed the impossibility of altering that decision. "It's awful. Oh, it's awful. Awful," Natasha suddenly cried, and again burst into sobs. "I shall die waiting a year. It's impossible. It's awful." She looked into her lover's face and saw in it a look of commiseration and perplexity. "No, no, I'll do anything," she said, suddenly checking her tears. "I am so happy." The father and mother came into the room and gave the betrothed couple their blessing. From that day, Prince Andrew began to frequent the Rostovs as Natasha's affianced lover. Alright, there we have it, another chapter down, and they sure are rushing in, and we all know who does that, as the saying goes, fools. What do you reckon of this? He's popped the question, But he's popped the question with this kind of caveat of we'll wait for a year, which he's happy to do. And he was even saying, you know, if you meet someone better in that time, all good, we'll call it off. I don't know if that's exactly how it goes to be engaged. Is that what an engagement period is? Like, try before you buy? I don't really know. I guess things were different back then. And also, 1 year isn't particularly, like, it's not a super long engagement by today's standards, but I think back then it was like a matter of weeks between engaged and married. Reddit user Chattel Veluster said, after a few days, when Natasha thinks that Andre has abandoned her, she begins her former way of life. She talks to herself in the words of a male third person about her good qualities. Do you think this way of thinking comes naturally to her, or do you think this is something she tries to do to make herself feel confident? Cy Nicholas responded, Natasha is probably just daydreaming, so it's equal parts fantasy and confidence boosting. She probably isn't fully aware what she is doing. Personally, I think that it comes from insecurity mixed with egoism. It's a conflict in mindsets that I experienced as a teenager and young man, where you oscillate between genuine confidence and crippling insecurity. This is her trying to solidify her self-image. This is how she wishes the world to see her. Yeah, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? That's the way that you do it. That's how you create a personality for yourself, is you sort of imagine it in retrospect, almost in a third person. Like that Andy, isn't he a great podcast host? Such a good voice, so well-spoken. And then, you know, you hope that that is, you fulfill that path. Although today I will apologize, and yesterday, I do have a cold. You've probably noticed my voice is kind of deep and nasally and kind of grimy. Grimy? Can you describe a voice as grimy? Well, I just did. Anyway, what were we talking about? Oh yeah, Natasha, not me. I really did think that was an interesting little insight to how Natasha sees herself, because we know she's got an interesting worldview. She's so naive, she's so optimistic and happy and bubbly, and she thinks the best of everyone. And we've seen that externally, we've seen how it plays out in the world, but we haven't really got a glimpse of how does she create that from within. And I think that sentence about that was kind of highlighted exactly that. It illustrated that, sorry. We see it as she kind of projects how the world will talk about her, especially from a male perspective, and then she goes about fulfilling that role. Reddit user Chattel Veluster also asked, we see after the proposal in both Natasha and Andre a change in mindset and soul. Andre's desires changes in pity, fear, and a joyful consciousness of duty. Natasha, thinking how there is to be no more toying with life, but that a responsibility is laid upon her for her very deed and word. For any of you who are married, can you relate to their thoughts during the proposal? I suppose that for the women it was different, as you were probably older than she is now, but I may be wrong. Again, Cy Nicholas responded saying, I'm not married, so I can't relate to this part of the chapter in the way the question is phrased. But I think for Natasha and Andre, the chase has ended. The excitement and mystery have led to concrete commitments, and the responsibility is daunting them. To them, sorry. Maybe like a child who begs for a pet dog for years and then finally gets one, they're now in the position to consider questions and scenarios they never dreamed of before. But now, because they take it seriously, they are a little overwhelmed. It is still positive, they still look forward to the future, but now it's real, and they don't want to mess it all up. That's a very interesting point, and actually, I think this chapter and that's especially the way Prince Andrew's attitude changed the instant that he'd made the proposal and it had been accepted, is a good way to illustrate and talk about the phenomena we know as cognitive dissonance. We've all heard of cognitive dissonance, and had it explained to us in a million different ways, but this is the perfect way to see it in a visceral, experience it in a visceral way where it clicks and goes, oh, I know that feeling, because it can be a tricky feeling to put your finger on. But what happened at the point where Prince Andre had committed and passed the point of no return, He couldn't back out. He had what we would call something like buyer's remorse. Not that he was remorseful, but that at the point of the commitment, all the intrusive thoughts that might have hindered your ability to make the commitment suddenly flood in. So those intrusive thoughts that might have hindered your ability to make the commitment were previously being rejected by your brain. That's the process of cognitive dissonance. So cognitive dissonance is there to protect a belief, I suppose, that is necessary to your brain. So in this case, what his brain wanted to achieve was to get married. In order to do that, he had to believe that Natasha was the perfect girl for him. So whenever some kind of intrusive fact or idea to the contrary that might have made him go, oh, wait a second, maybe this isn't the best idea. Whenever that tried to pop into his brain, cognitive dissonance, protecting that belief that she's perfect, would reject these thoughts because it was protecting a belief that was necessary to him. Does that make sense? Maybe I didn't explain that so right. Imagine that you're trying to buy a new bag. Right, this is how to feel about, this is how to explain buyer's remorse. You're trying to buy a new bag, you're trying to decide the best bag. You know, you find one that's perfect, you take it to the counter, but on the way to the counter you see another bag, and you go, ooh, should I get that one? Ah, no, I like this one. So you grab the bag you've got. As soon as the purchase is made and you're sort of exiting the store, you go, you know, that other bag had those extra pockets and those extra zips and the warranty was better and I think I like the color better as well. So what was happening there is at that moment there was something you had to achieve, the buying of a bag. It was necessary for you. Now, you'd convinced yourself that the bag you were holding was the right one for the job. Now, cognitive dissonance starts to protect that belief because that belief is actually functional for you at that point. That belief is helping you achieve the goal of buying a bag. So when these intrusive thoughts pop in, like extra pockets, longer warranty, those kinds of things, you actually reject them before you acknowledge them. And it's not until the cognitive dissonance has fulfilled its function, which is to allow you to buy a bag, that those intrusive thoughts will be allowed through the gates. So once the bag is bought, that belief that this bag is perfect is no longer necessary because you've finished your goal of buying a bag. The cognitive dissonance disappears. Sorry, we'll just wait for someone whose car is way too loud. The cognitive dissonance then disappears. And then those intrusive thoughts flood in, and that's buyer's remorse. So when you've felt buyer's remorse, you can know that cognitive dissonance has actually been at play in your mind. And I think this is exactly what's happening to Prince Andrew here. And I don't think he's remorseful, though. But I think his attitude shifts dramatically from, this girl's perfect, she's going to make me happy, this is all I want. The second it's committed, the cognitive dissonance that might have been blocking some other glaring truths, they flood in, and now it's like, oh gosh, now I'm responsible for this woman, now this woman's going to be the mother of my child, I've got to uphold my word, all these things. And he almost backpedals by saying, you know, if you find someone else in the meantime, that's okay, and I think he still wants to go through with it, but his attitude just shifts dramatically. And I do wonder how many people who have gone through the proposal and fiancé and, you know, getting engaged, getting married process have felt the same way. The help has felt those dramatic shifts in attitude at the point of no return, at all the various points of no return during that process. Anyway, I think that's going to do us for today. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.